Way of the Witchfinder by Brian Craig. There is, said the storyteller, a part of Britannia's coast which stands face to face with the great Western Ocean and engages in a constant contest with the sea. Sometimes the ocean retreats to expose new land, but in the end it takes back what it has yielded, and sometimes more. The legends of this region warn that when land is given by the sea, it will one day be reclaimed. Thus, the wisdom of legend says that fields may be planted year after year when the clean rain has washed away the salt from the soil, but that no man should claim lordship over such fields, because any citadel which is built there will one day be broken by the great grey waves. But there are in Britannia, as in all human lands, men who so yearn to be lords over their own kind that they are deaf to the wisdom of law and legend. And so it happens that whenever new fields are given by the sea to hungry toilers, there come after them those who would be their overlords, bearing warrants from kings who imagine that they have power to grant such favours. These lordlings build their castles, around which towns inevitably grow. They raise their petty armies and begin that business of robbery which the powerful call taxation. They grow fat and rich, and devote themselves increasingly to the cruel pleasures of tyranny and the vain pursuits of luxury, and sometimes turn, as the most corrupt of that kind often do, to the secret worship of forbidden gods. Then the common folk cry out in their anguish and their desperation. They look to the east, in the hope of summoning magicians who serve the better gods to deliver them from their demon-led lords. But should hopes of that kind prove futile, they must look to the west, whence come the great grey waves, which will drown their fields and their masters alike, and clear the way for a new beginning. The story which I have now to tell is of such a petty citadel, which was named by its founder Aura Lamay, and which had fallen after many generations into the untender care of one Bayard Solon, who governed his lands in the name of Charles II, the father of our own vainglorious king. Bayard Solon was himself governed, ultimately, by demons, many said, but more immediately and more obviously by his daughter, Cyrene, who was possessed of unnatural beauty and unnatural appetites. Her reign over her father and his people had not lasted long before the angry people began to implore their gods to send a champion to destroy her, and waited most anxiously to see if their prayers would be answered. There dwelt at that time in the foothills of the mountains which are called the Pale Sisters, a grey, gnarled priest of Solkan, named Yazus Fiem. He had travelled wildly through the northern lands, hunting out necromancers and demonologists and countless hedge-wizards of dubious repute. He had bested all those he had faced, for he had ever been a man of iron, merciless and utterly incorruptible. Perhaps the finest servant Solkan had ever found in a land where the gods of law had few followers. But even great magicians grow old, and the time had come when Yazus Fiem found a different ambition, and built a shrine to his angry god, intending to take an apprentice to whom he would teach all that he knew, and train most carefully, thus preparing a scourge for the followers of evil, who would be fiercer even than himself, fit to destroy the most powerful enemies a man of law might face. The apprentice he found was a youth named Florian, who was clear of eye and strong in wind and limb, and to this boy he taught all the disciplines of strictness, austerity, and repression, with such rigour that he made the boy absolute tyrant over his own flesh, and inflexible commander of his own will. He taught him also the secret language of law, and the awesome lexicon of banishment, which gave power to law's servants to drive demons back to their hellish seats and cleanse the world of change and chaos. For 13 years, Jesus Fiem kept Florian by his side, shaping and refining him in body and mind, straightening his every thought with the lineaments of law, until he was perfectly certain that he had made an instrument for Solkan more powerful and more skilled than he himself had been in his younger days. And when the boy was 21, Jesus Fiem prayed to Solkan for a sign which would tell him what to do next, and where to send the youth to do the work of law. In response to these prayers, Jesus Fiem was sent a dream, in which he saw the stern and stony face of his wrathful god, which said to him,
"There is a city named Ora-Lamay, far to the west. It is a very tiny city, but it harbours an evil out of all proportion to its size. It will provide the perfect test for the blade you have forged in my name, which will temper him if he is sound, and shatter him if he is weak. Give him my amulet of volcanic stone, and bid him remember the secret words which you have taught him. Send him forth to reclaim Ora-Lamay for the cause of law. But warn him sternly, lest his resolve be weakened by temptation."
And so Jesus Fiem brought forth an amulet of black volcanic rock, carved with powerful signs, and hung it around his acolyte's neck. Then he gave to the youth a staff of law, very straight and plain, cut from the heartwood of a great tall pine, and instructed him to use it well. And then, without a tear in his eye or any other signal of affectionate feeling, he pointed the way to Ora-Lamay, and sent Florian forth upon the rocky road. The regions which Florian crossed on his way to the ocean's shore were sparsely populated, save for a narrow strip to either side of the great highway, which runs south from Languille towards the ruins of once great Mousillon. There were few followers of the gods of law in those lands, but he found many to give him bread among the peasants and priests, who walked in fear of dark magic and knew him for its enemy. He was 30 days and 1 upon the road, which was often hard even for one as lithe and strong as he. But in the end he came to the lush lowlands which the sea had long since abandoned to the manifold crops of mankind, to turnips and beets, to barley and wheat, to lentils and apple trees. The walls of Ora-Lamay were not so very high, but the castle itself had one high tower, which loomed above the rest, black and forbidding. The sea could not be seen from the town wall, and was not often in the thoughts of those who made their homes within the wall. The guardsmen at the gate had grown complacent in the 10 long years since pirates had last attacked the town, and Florian came unchallenged to Ora-Lamay. He went immediately to the street of shrines beyond the marketplace, there to lay down a mat, as is the custom of wandering preachers in Bretonia, from which he could deliver his sermons and hear the pleas of any who had complaints to lay before the gods of law. The rumour of his arrival in the town passed quickly through the streets, and crowds soon gathered about his mat, curious as ever to see a new spellcaster and measure his worth. These crowds were not over-anxious to heed the message which he preached, which extolled the virtues of stern discipline and self-restraint. But they were ready enough to admire his strength and handsomeness, which seemed all the greater by virtue of his coldness. They were ready, too, to bring him news of many evils which were said to be abroad in the town, of children seized and murdered for their innocent blood, of lewd displays and dread perversions practised within the court, of strange madnesses and demonic possessions, and animal familiars. For 3 days they brought him such tales, and sometimes half a loaf of bread and a jug of wine, and in all that time he did not stray far from the street of shrines. While he heard what the people had to tell him, Florian was gradually overcome by sickening horror. He had little understanding of the magnifying ways of rumour and repetition, for his sheltered life had given him no opportunity to see how the best and least offensive of people lust after lurid gossip and increase it when they pass it on. He heard what was said of the Lord of Orelamay and his gaudy daughter, and he believed every word of it. By nightfall on the 3rd day, he was resolved to bring down the wrath of Sulcan upon the town in the fullest measure which his virtues could contrive. But when he laid himself prone upon his mat that night to offer up his prayers and beg for guidance from his God, he found only darkness and confusion in his mind. And though he strove as mightily as he could to see with his inner eye, no vision came. And when the criers called the hour after midnight, and all was still in the streets, there came to him a messenger, a golden-haired boy in a white tunic, who bid him follow. Follow he did, through the winding alleys behind the street of shrines, to an arched doorway in a tall, forbidding wall. Beyond the doorway, there were dim-lit mazy corridors and flights of stairs, which turned him about in his course so many times that he felt sure he could never retrace his steps without a guide. Eventually the messenger brought him into an apartment more brightly lit than the corridors, where there awaited him upon a crimson couch a woman no older than himself. Her hair was dark, but sleek enough to glitter as it caught the light. Her brown eyes were no less lustrous, and her lips were glossed with red, so that all her features seemed radiant. There was incense burning in the room, and the intoxicating vapours teased the mucous membranes of Florian's nose. "You are Florian, priest of law," said the woman, in a voice which was low and honey-sweet. "How quickly the news of your coming has spread through our realm. And you, a Cyrene called Sorceress," he replied, "whose infamy has long been known in its every quarter, do you summon me here to work for my destruction?" She only laughed at that and said, "I summoned you to see what you are like, and to show you what it is that you have sworn to destroy. Look at me, Florian, and imagine, if you can, what pleasures you could find in me, if you only had the wit to seek them out. Behold me, son of man, and ask whose face you would rather see in your dreams, when the burden of waking is lifted from your soul. Am I not more beautiful and Sulcan?" Florian's reply to this was to raise his staff of law and point it at her heart. "Do you deny, daughter of Bayard Solon," he said, "that you have consorted with demons? Do you deny that you have committed abominable crimes against man and law alike?" She placed her hand over her heart, but the gesture was a mocking one, making an insincere pretense of injury. "I deny nothing," she replied, "for if there are pleasures which I have not yet tasted, I would stop at nothing to obtain their savour. If demons can bring me ecstasy, I will yield myself to demons. If the sufferings of others will thrill my blood, I will contrive that suffering. Pleasure, not law, is the best measure of the things of this world, and where there is pleasure, there can be no crime. You do not know it now, but perhaps when you sleep, good Florian, your dreams will tell you a higher truth than your angry god of law would like you to hear. Then Florian began to chant the words of power which Jesus Fiem had taught him, calling upon Sulcan to come to his aid in blasting the enchantress from the face of the earth. But still she laughed, and the cloud of incense billowed about her, until she was utterly hidden from view. He heard her voice, saying, "Hearken to me, handsome youth, and learn that there is no sternness in all the world which cannot be melted by a loving heart." But in answer he cried, "No, it shall not be," and he called again on Sulcan to aid him in his struggle. Then it seemed that something struck him down, and when he rose again to his feet, he found that he was no longer in that chamber, but was instead upon his mat, beneath the stars, in the quiet street of shrines. Florian immediately fell prone upon his mat, and called upon Sulcan to give him strength. And when, in the fullness of time, he allowed himself to sleep, his sleep was quite untroubled by dreams, saving those of punishment and righteous wrath. And the seductive image of the sorceress Cyrene was kept at bay. In the morning, men-at-arms came to Florian and seized him in the name of Bayard Solon, and conveyed him through the alleyways behind the street of shrines to a postern gate in the castle wall. Once inside, they took him swiftly to the dungeons, where they cast him down into a noisome and filthy pit, replying to his protests that the laws of Ora Lemay reckoned it as dire an offence to hear treason as it was to speak it, and that he was guilty of both. They put a huge flat stone over the mouth of the pit to seal him in, and left him in darkness. This, he knew, was the beginning of his testing. Sulcan had allowed his enemies to cast him down so that he might rise again, if he could, to be a proper instrument of the wrath of law. With this in mind, he embraced the grimy stones of his prison and began an arcane chant, which was his declaration of war against the forces which sought to hold his power in check. "I will make the stone live," he swore to himself. "I will make the earth itself rise against those who have polluted it." For 3 days and 3 nights he continued his chant, drawing the power of Sulcan into his suffering body. His captors brought him neither food nor water, but he did not care, for there was a different nourishment working in his soul. As he pronounced the final verses of his exorcism, he felt the amulet upon his breast grow hot and bright, and the pit was filled with the cold and silver light of law, which recognized no colors. The staff of law which he held in his two hands throbbed with power, so that when he touched it to the stone wall that confined him, the stone seemed to peel away, splitting asunder to make a path for him which led outwards and upwards towards the very heart of Ora Lemay's citadel. And as he marched upon the newly formed stair, he began a new and triumphant chant, which grew louder and louder, as the voice of Sulcan joined with his in a mighty hymn to order and destruction. When he came again into the corridors of the citadel, he was met by men-at-arms with halberds and partisans, who tried to hack at him and strike him down, but he whirled his staff about him, and the power flowed from its ends to break their weapons and drive them to their knees. "I am law," he sang between the choruses of his awesome spell. "Temptation has not touched me, and passion has no place in my heart. I am law, and I come to deliver retribution in the name of Sulcan, scourge of change and chaos. There came against him then a host of strange shadows, beings of other worlds, still half confined there, which took the guise of monsters in exerting their vicious will upon the hedonists of Orr-la-May. But their talons, and their fangs, and their deadly stings could no more prick him than the clumsy weapons of the soldiers. His amulet burned, and his staff twirled, and the monstrous shadows were swept into whirlpools in the air, which denied them their horrid aspect and swallowed them up entirely. "Demons, lose your hold upon this place," he sang, swollen with honest pride in his virtue and his power. "Evil, be gone. I am law, and cannot be resisted. I am law, and will take my course." And so, with Sulcan guiding his footsteps, Florian came to that part of the castle of Orr-la-May which was made into a palace for its lord and its mistress, where the walls were hung with tapestries and curtains, and the furnishings were a riot of colour and comfort. The colour was blasted from cushions and tapestries alike by the cold white light of lore. The burning incense was gutted in its pots, crystal shattered, spilling dark red wines to stain the floor. And from somewhere in the whirlwind of righteous wrath came the sound of screaming. But Florian saw nothing. So high was the pitch of his excitement now. His mighty voice boomed out the syllables of power, and the very earth awoke, as he had promised it should, to do the bidding of law.
"Sulcan! Sulcan! Sulcan!" he cried, with the rapture of possession and the icy coldness of unbreakable resolve. And when the spell was finished, and he looked about him, he found that he had come to the very top of Orr-la-May's tower, and stood now on the high platform where the sentries were put to watch the silver ribbon of the distant sea for the white of pirate sails. No sentry was on that rampart now, but only the man of law with his mighty staff, which had cut the heart of demonic corruption from the court of Bayard Solon, and cauterized the wound with cold, white fire. He heard a sound behind him then, and turned to see the sorceress Cyrene stumbling upon the rampart. He thought for a moment that she was come to bring one last blow to be struck against him by the forces of evil. But she had no weapon in her hand, nor demonic power in her eyes. She no longer shone with her unnatural glamour, and had lost the natural bloom of youth, along with her stolen glory. She was dull now, and helpless. He looked at her, and said, "See what your temptations have come to, my pretty princess. How feeble were your charms against the strength of law. Did you really think that you could awaken lust in one such as me, who had Jesus Fiem to teach him, and Sulcan for my inspiration? Learn, then, how impotent evil is against the true will and the stern soul." And when she looked at him, he saw in her eyes that she had indeed learned what folly it had been to oppose him so lightly, with laughter and temptation. He saw that she knew pain now, as well as pleasure, and knew which was stronger in the world, and what price was ordained by destiny for the luxurious to pay. She did not call him fool now, nor did she seek to wake his passion with the promise of her flesh. Instead, she only begged him for his help, pleading with him to save her life, to save her from the very forces which she had sought to command. "I will be whatever you want me to be," she said. "I will do whatever penance you demand. Only save me from the vengeance of the people and the wrath of the demons with which I made treaty. Only save me now that you have destroyed all that I had and all that I loved."
And then, as Florian stared at her, she fell upon her knees and put her arms across her bosom as though trying to hide within herself from everything that was outside her. Florian looked down at her, and suddenly, because he could not help himself, he felt a pang of pity. Then the staff of law became quiet in his hand, as though it were only wood, and the amulet upon his chest ceased to burn with righteous fire, and became as heavy as a dead stone, and the grandiose spell which had possessed his mind and made him more than human faded in his imagination to a plaintive echo. But still, he could not help himself. He looked at the frail woman who had been the sorceress Cyrene, and saw again through the dullness of her presence the brightness of what she once had been. Lust did not trouble him, so well had Jesus Fiem taught him what a man of law must know and what a man of law must be. But pity, in spite of all that he had done, he had not conquered. The temptation to lust he had resisted, but he had not properly learned that there were in the world other temptations which might touch his heart. Then he knew that the test of worthiness which had tried his power against the might of Orelame's demons was not yet done, and that as a sword of Sulcan he was not yet tempered and might yet break. He opened his mouth to speak to the stricken Cyrene, but for a fatal moment he did not know what to say. When he did speak, it was to damn himself. For what he said was, "Do not weep, my lady. Perhaps there is forgiveness in the world, as well as law." He looked away towards the west to hide the feeling which had cracked the ice that Jesus Fiem had laboured so long to put about his heart and soul. Then he saw something which made him catch his breath in fearful surprise. From the fields and the farmhouses of the realm, people were on the move, with their horses and their loaded wagons and their flocks of geese, carrying whatever they could upon their backs. They were not heading towards the town, but were trudging eastwards, away from the distant sea, as if they had known from the beginning that he who had come to claim their lands for law would fail in his resolve. He wanted to call out to them, to tell them that there was no need for them to flee, because he had cleansed the town and the castle of evil. But when he opened his mouth, he found that he had no voice. And when he looked again to the west, he saw that the great grey waves were already beginning to eat up the land which the sad cold sea had given, for a while, to the charge and use of man.
The religions of Warhammer present a simple and neat series of layered concepts. First, there is the straightforward what-ifs of offering us a world which is 15th century Western Europe, but in which polytheism has continued to be the order of the day. The favouring of a particular cult, therefore, adds colour and culture to a particular location, while you get the contrast of the regional inclinations that lean towards one god like Tal or Manon, alongside the universality of a cult like that of More. You then also have the pastiche of the schism of the Reformation in the tensions between Ulrich and Sigmar. I'd add here that of all the religions, Sigmar is a slightly odd man out because of its status as a state religion, with its strictures linked to the historical specifics of the state's formation, hate goblins, help dwarves, whereas all the others seem to reflect some sort of primal force or principle within the world. The upshot of this is that Sigmar becomes a sort of bland good god that wants to defeat baddies, but has no particular guidance about how that might be gone about. Hammer Christianity. But without even a cult of sacrifice, suffering, or self-denial. I mean, there are flagellants, but why are there flagellants? Why does the Hammer Man ascended to godhood want that? There's a brief discussion in The Empire Within of an Ulrichian heresy that claims that Sigmar isn't really a god, and I think that would prove to be an interesting interpretation of the idea around a historical figure who is meant to have ascended to godhood. My personal belief around the religion of the Seven in A Song of Ice and Fire is that it's a sham religion in a world where other gods have demonstrable magical powers. And one wonders about what a version of Warhammer would be like if Sigmar was just the same. But that would require a reworking of the way in which all the gods worked, as Sulkhan would have far more converts if he was the one who could melt stone through magic, and Sigmarites mainly just had hammer and comet-branded merchandise. Beyond these gods of human concerns stand the gods of chaos and law. The idea of chaos as an expression of core human feelings was not fully dominant during the writing of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, which I will always argue was the main text Craig was working with. I strongly suspect he had not read Realm of Chaos at this point in time, and instead we have much more of a sense of chaos as an abominable force of constant change. This can be diminished even further into becoming merely a form of Satanism and demon pact making that is more Hammer horror than Michael Moorcock. Again, this is not entirely Craig's fault, as the career path of demonologist and the generic nature of some of the sample demons in the core book all argue that this form of interaction with chaos does take place. But this story does not give us any interesting takes on chaos, and is instead a nondescript hodgepodge of infant cannibalism and eyes wide shut. Where things get more interesting is in the domain of lore. The idea that there might be gods of lore at all pulls us away from the ersatz Satanism versus the human gods, and we begin to touch on the idea that there might be more cosmic forces at work. Having said that, Sulkhan is not a promisingly sketched deity, with his characterization in Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay and elsewhere really amounting to cross. When you think about it, one of the ideas of lore is that it should reject the changeability of high emotions and human passions. But being very cross about things is clearly a human passionate emotion. I'm immediately reminded of the film Equilibrium, which depicts a society that drugs its population to stop them having intense emotional experiences and arrests those that do, but where, as Abigail Thorne observes on the Kill James Bond podcast review of the film, the people enforcing the drugging and arresting regime are clearly experiencing the intense emotion of anger at the thought of people having intense emotions. So having Sulkhan just seem to be cross about chaos worship is a bit unimaginative and also fairly nonsensical. Graham Davis created Sulkhan, and he describes the motivation for his creation being that it wasn't particularly clear what any of the gods of lore actually did. He said, "I decided that the existing gods of lore were too abstract, too waffy, to use the studio slang term, to be of very much use in the game. shamelessly stealing the name and image of Robert E. Howard's Puritan adventurer, Solomon Kane, I created a patron for witch hunters and all others who sought to take the fight to chaos. This, of course, is a classic example of something making sense in a game, but not necessarily on a metaphysical level. Why would a god of law want vengeance? But like so much in Games Workshop, it makes for evocative images, so long as you don't think about it at all. At this point, I should probably mention a document written by Rick Priestley called Chaos, A Guide to the Fictional Background of Chaos in GW Games. You can find it in a post on the Awesome Lies blog called The Nature of Chaos. In this document, Priestley lays out some of the metaphysics of the Warhammer world, possibly, this blog post argues, as a means of explaining to the incoming Warhammer fiction authors how everything works. Here we rather shockingly hear that the powers of law are entities which exist within chaos, just like the powers of chaos themselves. It could be said that a power of law is a single aspect of a great power of chaos, which could well be the case. But I think this paradox would be a bit of a head spinner for most of our readers. The strict division of power into the two pantheons of law and chaos is little more than a question of perception by their worshippers. End quote. With this in mind, it raises the possibility that Solkan is a very orderly reflection of Khorne, something this story does not explore further in any way. I am not unconvinced by the idea that Craig was working with this document, though, not least because the story references Florian's magic being without colour, and this document holds one of our earlier references to the idea of colours of magic. I really can't recommend Awesome Lies enough, guys. Go and check it out. These speculations aside, what worked quite well in the depiction of Solkan was in Florian failing because he experienced pity. Now, obviously, we can't ignore the fact that that could just be a pastiche of pop culture ideas about witch hunters, the Solomon Kane aesthetic of Solkan, influenced in turn by Puritans, could argue that this rejection of emotion and feeling is just a reflection of an idea about the hard-heartedness of early modern low church Protestantism in the style of the Salem witch hunt. Although neither the illustration or the descriptions of what Solkan worshippers are like in this story reflect that. And if anything, Florian seems to have the feel of an early church father living as a hermit in the desert. But we could argue that Florian's moment of pity is when we realise that Craig has actually managed to show us a religion that isn't just some Christian principles wrapped up in a fantasy skin. Florian loses the support of his god because he experiences a recognisable moment of humanity. This is a god that doesn't want its human followers to be human. It wants to calcify them into something void of that humanity. I don't feel like this was a pastiche of the callousness of the medieval Christian zealot. Kill them all, God will know his own. But rather a god that wants no feelings from its followers at all. A sort of cosmic indifference. This led me to wonder if Solkan's anger is really an attempt to put a name to an impulse that humans cannot readily understand. Or he could just be an idea that got bashed out in the last minute in the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay rulebook. Some of the writers fixate on it because they are all of an age where they've read a fair amount of Moorcock, so law versus chaos seems significant somehow, and so the concept of law actually gets far more coverage in the fiction, it will come up again in Zaragoz, than anywhere else in the world of Warhammer. Could also be that, and then me trying to project something interesting onto it, I suppose. In doing my Solkan research, I was reminded that he is the god to whom that jigsaw amulet that you got in Advanced Hero Quest was meant to belong. The background on it in the Advanced Hero Quest rulebook tells us that Solkan doesn't care about the lives of his followers, which is interesting, and also that he can manifest as a living being on this planet, which raises a lot more questions than it answers as a phenomenon. Back with the story, I have to say that the idea of the land that will inevitably sink beneath the waves does have that entropy-tinctured futility that I enjoy elsewhere in these stories, even with the vaguely fairy-tale atmosphere that Craig likes to project across everything. I think the final scene had an impact as a mood piece that probably has a bit more impact than everything that precedes it, partly because what's going on and how it relates to Sulcan's judgment or refusal to assist isn't entirely clear. The story is also weirdly short. I initially assumed it was because all of the other Wolf Riders stories were slightly longer than those in Ignorant Armies, but they aren't. Wolf Riders is just shorter, and has a bunch of adverts at the back, certainly in my copy, to fill out the pages. So maybe it is simply the case that Craig felt he had said all he had to say. It's also odd that it's his second story in the collection, and that led me to wonder if it was dropped into the collection to fill the gap for a story that didn't materialise. As you might have guessed, I didn't find the story particularly inspiring. It had its moments. I found it useful to use as a jumping-off point to think about religion in the Warhammer world, but these are not stories or characters that draw you in. Please feel free to comment on the show in the posts in the Oldhammer, Rogue Trader or Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay First Edition Facebook groups, or to leave a review if you are so inclined. Please tell friends if this is the type of thing that might interest them. You can also follow me on Twitter, where I post at Lewis Kerno about, well, history, this podcast, RPGs, miniatures, and Turnip 28. Next time, we are on to the final of our Brian Craig stories, The Light of Transfiguration.